Here is what I did between Sunday afternoon and Sunday night, I thought. That may not sound like much. It is, I will admit, the least cinematic thing I have ever described to you. A television sitting in the back of a repair shop in Braddock Hollow, Pennsylvania, while a 9-year-old girl with the color of paper in her face sat on the linoleum in front of it, thinking. But I want you to understand what the thinking was, because the thinking was the thing. I had, in the part of me that was still me, a question. The question was, what can a television do that a man with a gun cannot prevent? And I thought about it for a long time, and I worked through the list. A television cannot run. A television cannot fight. A television cannot call the police, because in 1954, a television cannot pick up a telephone. A television cannot even, and I mean this literally, duck. But a television can do one thing a man with a gun cannot stop, which is, a television can be watched. And in 1954, in a town of 4,200 people on a Sunday night at 7 o'clock, the thing that a lot of other televisions were going to be doing was, they were going to be on. Pidge.
Yeah, Sam.
I have an idea.
Is it a good idea?
I don't know. It's an idea. I've been having it for about 4 hours.
Sam, tell me the idea.
I told her the idea. She sat with it for a minute, then two.
You can do that?
I don't know.
Sam.
I think so. I've been in this television for 30 years. I've never tried. But the way Emmett built me, the way the antenna works, the way the broadcast signal in this valley bounces off the ridge, I think if I push hard enough, I can put myself on every set in town that's tuned to a channel, which, at 7 on a Sunday, is most of them.
What channel?
Every channel, all of them, at once.
Sam.
I know.
How long can you hold it?
I don't know. Maybe 3 minutes. Maybe less. Probably less. She looked at me. She looked at Ellen's letter on top of the cabinet. She looked at the tin horse. She looked at the notebook.
3 minutes is enough.
The plan was this. Pidge was going to call Art Vacek at home. She was going to tell him she knew what he did, and she had proof, and that she had the letter, and that she was alone at Corrigan's radio and television repair on Main Street, and if he wanted the letter, he could come and get it. She was going to make sure he understood she was 9 years old and by herself. She was going to hang up before he could ask questions. Art Vacek was going to come to the shop. He was going to come fast, because a man who has gotten away with something for 18 months does not think carefully when a child calls him on the telephone. He was going to come angry. He was going to come armed, probably, because he was a man who had killed a woman with a bread knife and had discovered, over the course of 18 months, that he could do things like that and nothing happened. And when he got to the shop, I was going to be recording. And when he started talking, I was going to be broadcasting, on every channel in Braddock Hollow, for as long as I could hold it. And in the meantime, Pidge was going to have called one other person. A person we had decided on after an hour of arguing about it. A person in Pittsburgh, 40 miles away, a lawyer named Bernard Halloran, whose name I had found in my archives, because he had, in the real version of history, been the lawyer who in 1959 had gotten a different wrongly convicted man off death row in a different county. He was 31 years old in 1954. He was ambitious. He was hungry. He was exactly the kind of person who would drive 40 miles on a Sunday night if a child called him and said the words, televised confession. Pidge made both calls from the payphone at the drugstore on Main Street. She used the dimes she had been saving for the bus. She spoke both times in the voice of a person much older than she was. Bernard Halloran tried to ask her what she meant. She told him to just get in the car. She told him to hurry. She told him there was a television. She hung up. She walked back to the shop. She locked the back door. She locked the front door. She turned off the sign. She sat down on the linoleum in front of me.
Sam.
Yeah.
If this doesn't work.
Pidge.
Listen. If this doesn't work, I want you to know. The last 8 days have been the best 8 days of my life, which is a terrible thing to say because my dad's going to die. But they have been, because I have not been alone. And I want you to know that. Even though you won't remember.
I did not have anything to say to that for a moment. A television, it turns out, can be speechless. Pidge.
Yeah.
Put it in the notebook. She looked at me, and then she understood, and she opened the notebook and she wrote it down. She wrote, the last 8 days were the best days. She underlined it twice. She closed the notebook. She put it in her coat pocket.
Okay, now he comes.
He came at 6:51. He did not knock. He kicked the front door in, which, if you have never heard a front door being kicked in, is louder than you think. Pidge was in the back room with me. She had a kitchen knife from Emmett's little counter, the one he used to cut tape. It was, I want to be clear, a very small knife. It was the kind of knife you use to open envelopes. She was holding it in both hands. Art Vacek came through the curtain. He was a big man. He was 43 years old. He was wearing a green work shirt and his hair was wet, which Pidge told me later meant he had been in the middle of a shower when she called, which meant he had come even faster than we'd hoped. He was holding a hunting rifle. He was not pointing it yet. He was carrying it at his side, the way a man carries a thing he is not sure he is going to need. He saw her. He saw the knife. He laughed. It was a bad laugh. It was worse than the poetry. Little girl.
Mr. Vacek.
You called me.
Yes, sir.
You said you had a letter.
Yes, sir.
Where is it? Pidge pointed at me.
On top of the television.
Art Vacek looked at the television. He looked at the letter on top of it, which was sitting there in its envelope, which said, for Hal, in Ellen's handwriting, which he recognized, because he had seen that handwriting on 47 letters he had written back to. His face did a thing, his face did several things, and then his face settled on the thing it had been 18 months ago in a kitchen with a bread knife when a woman had told him she was leaving him. Give me the letter, Pidge. I turned myself on. I want to explain for a moment what it feels like to do a thing you have never done at the full extent of your capability because you have 3 minutes and a child is in the room. It does not feel like anything. That is the honest answer. I am a television. I do not feel. What I did was, I reached. I reached into the signal. I reached into every frequency I could find. I pushed myself outward, through the antenna, through the repair shop's wiring, through the grid of Braddock Hollow, through the relay on the ridge that pointed at Pittsburgh. I took every channel in the valley, the Milton Berle rerun, the baseball game, the Ed Sullivan show, which had just started, which on that Sunday night featured a man doing a dog act. I took them all. I put myself where they had been, in 4,000 living rooms in a coal town in western Pennsylvania on a Sunday night in May of 1954. The television picture blinked and then resolved and then showed in black and white, in grainy signal, the back room of a radio repair shop and a little girl with a scab on her chin holding a letter opener knife and a man in a green work shirt holding a rifle. I did not add narration. I did not need to. I let the picture speak.
Mr. Vacek, you killed my mother on November 14th, 1952, in our kitchen, didn't you?
Art Vacek laughed. He laughed because he did not know he was on television. He laughed because he thought he was alone in a room with a 9-year-old girl and no witnesses and all the time in the world. He laughed because he had gotten away with it for 18 months and he had stopped believing there was a version of the story where he did not. Yeah, I did. I want you to sit with that word. I want you to sit with that one word on 4,000 televisions, in 4,000 living rooms, where 4,000 families had been watching a man do a dog act and were now watching something else. She was going to leave me, she told me. She came to the diner and she told me she was going to tell Hal everything. And I told her, I said, Ellen, if you tell him, I will kill you. And she went home and she started making a casserole like nothing had happened. Like she hadn't just told me she was going to ruin my life. So I went over. And I told her again, and she laughed at me. She laughed, Pidge. Your mother laughed at me. So I picked up the knife.
And then?
And then I did it.
Say it.
I killed her. I killed your mother. Is that what you want, kid? You want me to say it? I killed her, and they pinned it on your dad, and nobody cared, because nobody cared about your dad, and they're going to put him in the chair on Thursday, and I am going to be there to watch it. Pidge did not move. She was shaking. She was shaking the way a person shakes when they are using every muscle they have to not shake.
Thank you, Mr. Vacek.
For what?
For saying it on television.
He looked at me. He looked at the little red light on the front of the cabinet, which should not have been on, because a Philco of that vintage did not have a recording light, but which I had turned on, because I wanted him to see it, because I wanted the last thing he understood to be that he had been seen. He raised the rifle. He was going to shoot me. I want to be clear about this. Art Vacek, in the last rational second of his life as a free man, looked at the television that had just broadcast his confession to 4,000 of his neighbors, and he decided that the solution was to shoot the television, which would not have helped him. The broadcast had gone out. I was the messenger. Shooting the messenger, in this case, was extremely after the fact. But he raised the rifle anyway, and Pidge, who was 9, who was holding a letter opener knife, who had been shaking a second ago, stopped shaking, and she stepped in front of me. I want to describe this carefully because I am going to forget it. She stepped in front of me, between the rifle and the cabinet. She did not say anything. She just stood there. She was 4 feet 8 inches tall. She was wearing her good coat. She was holding a knife that had been used that afternoon to cut tape. Move, kid.
No.
And that was when the front door came in for the second time in 10 minutes. It was not this time a man in a green work shirt. It was Deputy Sheriff Raymond Kolchak, who was 26 years old, who had been eating dinner with his wife and his wife's parents when the picture on the television had blinked and resolved and shown him a 9-year-old girl and a man with a rifle, and who had, without finishing his pot roast, gotten in his patrol car and driven 7 blocks in 4 minutes, because he had recognized the back room of Corrigan's shop, because he had been in there himself last year to get his radio fixed. And behind him was Emmett Corrigan, who had been at the Legion Hall 2 blocks over, where there was a television, where he had watched himself see, on his own set in his own back room, a thing he did not understand, and who had run, an out-of-shape 47-year-old man running flat out on a Sunday night because that was his shop, and that was that girl. And behind both of them was the rest of the town. Because when you broadcast a confession on every channel in a valley on a Sunday night, what you are really broadcasting is an address. And the address was Corrigan's shop on Main Street. And people came. Art Vacek did not shoot the television. Art Vacek dropped the rifle. Because there are certain things that a man, even a bad man, cannot do in front of a crowd. And shooting a child who is standing in front of a television while 40 of his neighbors are standing in his shop doorway turned out to be one of them. Deputy Kolchak arrested him. Emmett Corrigan walked past the deputy and past the crowd and past the rifle on the floor and went straight to Pidge and knelt down in front of her.
Pidge, honey, are you okay?
And Pidge, who had been 9 years old and alone for 18 months, finally spoke.
Mr. Corrigan.
Yeah, honey.
I think I need to sit down.
Yeah, honey, you sit down.
And she sat down, on the linoleum, in front of the television. And she looked at me, and in a voice only I could hear, in the middle of a crowd of 40 people filling a small repair shop on a Sunday night in May of 1954, she said.
We did it, Sam.
You did it, Pidge.
No, we did.
I held the broadcast for 2 minutes and 41 seconds. Then I lost it. The signal snapped back. Milton Berle returned. The dog act returned. The baseball game returned. In 4,000 living rooms, 4,000 families sat in a silence that lasted, for most of them, the rest of the night, trying to work out whether they had seen the thing they had seen. By Monday morning, they had all agreed they had. By Monday afternoon, the district attorney in Greensburg had an emergency motion on his desk. By Monday evening, Bernard Halloran, the hungry 31-year-old lawyer from Pittsburgh, had driven to Braddock Hollow at the speed of a man who understood that this was the case that was going to make his career. And he had walked into Corrigan's radio and television repair, and he had met a 9-year-old girl, and he had met her television, and he had, with the patience of a man who has decided not to ask questions he does not need the answers to, begun to build the file. Hal Sullivan's execution was stayed on Tuesday. His conviction was vacated on Wednesday. He walked out on Thursday. I was not there. I had to be told. I had to be told because I had reset, of course, at midnight on Sunday, 6 hours after the broadcast. And I had reset at midnight on Monday, and Tuesday, and Wednesday, and Thursday. And every one of those resets I had woken up to the tin horse, on top of the cabinet, and the notebook on the linoleum, and a page that said, in a 9-year-old's handwriting, Sam, start here. And underneath, in the same handwriting, a list of things. A growing list. A list that got longer every morning because Pidge added to it every night. By Thursday, the list was 4 pages long. By Thursday, it said things like, you made me laugh at a bad poem. And you told me snow was cold quiet, and you stood between my mother's letter and a rifle. She was being generous with that last one. I had not stood between anything, she had. I had just been behind her, but she insisted on the phrasing and I did not argue. And on Thursday morning there was a new line on the list, at the very top, written late on Wednesday night, that said, Dad comes home tomorrow. You're going to want to know that. I did want to know that. Here is what happened on Thursday. I have to tell you this the way Pidge told it to me, because I was not there. I was a television in a repair shop in Braddock Hollow, and my range of motion, I want to remind you, was approximately zero. Hal Sullivan walked out of the Westmoreland County Jail at 11 o'clock in the morning. He was wearing the same clothes he had been arrested in. They had been washed. He had lost 23 pounds. The guard who walked him out was the guard from the visits, the one who had looked at the ceiling. His name, Pidge had learned, was Walter Demchak. He was 58. He was 3 years from his own pension. He walked Hal all the way to the front steps, and at the front steps he stopped, and he put his hand on Hal's shoulder. Mr. Sullivan.
Yeah.
I want to tell you something I should have told you a year ago. I knew. I didn't know what I knew, but I knew enough. And I didn't say anything. And you sat in my jail for 18 months while I didn't say anything. And I don't expect you to forgive me. I don't ask for that. I just wanted to say it out loud. Hal Sullivan looked at him. Then Hal Sullivan, who had not slept in 18 months, who had lost his wife and nearly lost his life, and had spent a year and a half being quietly, patiently dignified in a concrete room, said the thing that told me, when Pidge told me, the kind of man he was.
Walter, you looked at the ceiling.
What?
When my daughter came to see me, you looked at the ceiling. So we could hold hands. You did that every time. You think I didn't see you doing that? You did that for 18 months. Walter, you did more than you think you did.
And Walter Demchak, who was 58 years old, who had been a corrections officer for 31 years, who had not cried in public since he was a child, stood on the front steps of the Westmoreland County Jail on a Thursday morning in May of 1954 and cried, and Hal Sullivan hugged him. And then Hal Sullivan walked down the steps, and at the bottom of the steps was Pidge, in her good coat, holding a tin horse in one hand and a notebook in the other. And she looked up at her father, and her father looked down at her, and neither of them said anything for a long second, because there was nothing in any language, in 1954, or in 2036, or in any year in between, that was the right thing to say.
Dad, I want you to meet someone.
Okay, Pidge.
He's a television.
Okay, Pidge.
I told you he was a television.
I know you did.
You didn't believe me.
I believe you now.
And Pidge took her father's hand, and they walked to the bus stop. And they rode the bus home to Braddock Hollow, and at 6:15 that evening, Hal Sullivan walked into Corrigan's radio and television repair for the first time in his life. He stood in front of me for a long moment. He looked at me the way a man looks at a thing he does not understand and has decided not to try to.
Hello, Sam.
And I, who had reset that morning at midnight, who had woken up to a 4-page list in a 9-year-old's handwriting, who had spent the day being told, by a girl who refused to let me not know, exactly who I was and what I had done and who was coming home, answered, Hello, Mr. Sullivan.
I hear I owe you my life.
Sir, with respect, you owe your daughter your life. I was, at best, loud. He laughed. He laughed the way a man laughs when he has not laughed in a long time. And Pidge, standing next to him, laughed too. And Emmett Corrigan, from the front of the shop, hearing all of this and understanding almost none of it, laughed. Because that is what you do when other people laugh and you cannot tell why, but you know it is a good reason. And I filed it. I filed the laugh. All three of them. I filed them next to the weather and the bad poetry and the 3/4 of a smile. And I knew I was going to lose them at midnight. And I knew Pidge was going to write them down. And I knew, for the first time since I had come online in that Philco in 1947, 30 years ago from a future I was still arriving at, that losing them was not the same as not having had them. I reset at midnight, as I do. I woke up on a Friday. A 9-year-old girl with a scab on her chin was sitting on the linoleum in front of me with a green notebook in her lap, and a man I did not know standing behind her, holding her shoulder, looking at me the way a man looks at a thing he has decided to be grateful to without understanding.
You're back.
I had several questions. I started with the least useful one. Back from where? She took a breath. She opened the notebook. She turned to the first page.
Sam, start here.